Today on Ag News Daily.
We always gravitate towards the stories of real people, you know, and it's the idea that, you know, there are everyday heroes around us.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Mike Pearson here, co-host of the Ag News Daily podcast, joined by Delaney Howell. Delaney, how you doing today?
Mike, my brain is fried right now.
Oh, been up to Colorado, have you?
No, like, I feel like my brain is about to explode.
Oh, all right. Little Thursday fun day, huh?
No, it's because of all this assistance package stuff that's been announced.
Exactly. That's what I figured. I was you know, trying to lead you astray.
Thanks.
Lead you into the weeds, take you towards Satan, so to speak.
No, I'm good.
Good. Good for you. You withstood the test. This was your trial in the wilderness. I'm glad you passed.
Thank you.
Yes. So, listeners, for those of you who have been working today and not all that tuned in to the BS that comes out of Washington, D.C., Delaney and I, luckily, have been doing that for you. Earlier this morning, I was on the media call with Secretary Sonny Perdue, Undersecretary Bill Nordy, Ted McKinney, Greg Ibach, and a few other, I guess, USDA type of people. And they unveiled officially the new MFP market facilitation program, mm-hmm. and it turns out it is nothing like the plan that was posted on Monday by the Trump administration, and it turns out it is just kind of still a work in progress.
It wasn't posted by the Trump administration. It was posted by Bloomberg, right. Reuters, and other agencies.
Right, sourced to the Trump administration.
Right.
But, yeah, you're exactly right, Delaney. We all kind of jumped the gun on that deal here in two social for soybeans. That's not the case. 4 cents for corn, not the case in 63 cents, I think, for wheat, not the case. Instead, this round of MFP payments is going to be $14.5 billion
mm-hmm.
divided up into three separate payments.
Theoretically.
Yeah. All of this is still theoretical. But this is what they said on the call. So we at least know it's coming from the administration.
Yep.
We've got a little bit of faith in it. They are going to break this up. They do expect the first payment to be the bigger of
mm-hmm.
the three.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be based on any kind of corn or soybean or wheat plantings this year. Instead, the USDA is going to calculate a payment rate per county looking at, we don't know, but I assume historical planting data and which commodities have been harmed by the trade war. And they're looking at not just at the trade war with China. Now we're also including damages caused by tariffs going into the EU and Turkey. And they're not just looking back over the past 10 months. They're looking back. They didn't give a firm range, but it sounded as though Secretary Perdue said 5 years.
Oh, they're looking back for trade influence from 5 years ago?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So this is kind of a catch-up payment for all of these past trade war issues. So it's going to be interesting. Delaney, I know you've listened to that call. I recorded it this morning. Folks, we might play some clips from it if we can figure out which parts of it actually matter to play. But it was 40 minutes, and I didn't get any smarter.
Yeah, I think, if anything, this round of payments confuses folks a lot more. So I've been trying to do some research and catch up myself, and we're working right now to hopefully bring on Scott Irwin, who's over there at Illinois Extension.
He's at the University of Illinois.
Yep. So hopefully provide some clarity. But here is kind of what I have figured out from unpacking all of this. So everything, Mike, you said so far is true. The first round of payments, it looks like, is going to be July or August.
Yep.
And the thing that I think is confusing is these payments are based off of a basket of commodities. So all grains are getting lumped into one payment rate. So regardless of
they're all getting lumped into the category that will determine the county's payment rate.
Well, right. But regardless of if you plant corn, soybeans, rye, rapeseed, canola, et cetera, you're going to get the same payment rate for other producers in your county.
Yes. Yes.
So
on a per acre basis,
right.
I think.
So it's based on acres planted. It's kind of a combination of things from the formula. From what I expect, it's acres planted, historical yields for that county, and also I don't know how they're figuring this out, but impact that your specific county has had because of tariffs and trade war, et cetera.
Yeah, so my guess is, and again, this is just me spitballing here, I think what they're going to do is, let's, for example, look at Grundy County, Iowa. Mm-hmm. They're on a corn and soybean rotation, a lot of corn on corn ground up there. So if soybeans are the hardest hit by this trade war, which at least they are with China, the soybean ratio for Grundy County is going to be a little bit smaller than in a southern Iowa county where they're on a true 50-50 ratio and they plant mm-hmm. more beans more often looking at historical data. I imagine they're going to go off FSA acreage numbers.
Right. And one of the questions that yeah. was raised, I saw this question on Twitter. I thought it was a great question. What if you are planting something that the county doesn't have production history for? Like, what if you plant rapeseed or canola or something in a county that has traditionally not planted that commodity?
Yeah, I don't know. Or I suppose a similar question could be looked at with soybeans in some parts of North and South Dakota mm-hmm. where they've just recently, you know, broken that ground and put
right.
beans in.
Yeah, so that's one of the questions. Another piece of this puzzle that I think is going to absolutely affect acreage for this year is prevent plant acres will not be included. So if you opt in and decide to take prevent plant on some of your grounds, you cannot apply for assistance package on those acres.
Okay, so they're still distorting the market.
Yes, that's kind of what it sounds like here, to me at least.
Okay, I didn't catch that on the phone call, so we're going to have to do some digging. That's phenomenally stupid if that's what they're doing.
Right, because, I mean, you look at it and you think, okay, well, maybe people physically cannot get corn acres in, but they want to get this payment, so then they're going to switch to beans or wheat or something else that maybe we obviously don't really need right now in the marketplace.
Right. I mean, this is still going to push folks to grow beans, I would think, because of their yeah. later planting date.
Yeah, so that's kind of the puzzle unpacked a little bit. We're going to try, like I said, and get some other folks smarter than Mike and I on the podcast to unpack this a little bit more. But President Trump is also addressing the nation's farmers today. As we are recording it, he is about to go live here. He's chatting at 2:15 Central Time or 3:15 Eastern Time. And that is right now while we're recording this. So I am going to be refreshing here on Twitter, pulling up my handy-dandy tweet machine, and if anything if anything important gets said here over the next couple of minutes, I'll be sure and jump in with that as well.
Excellent. Yeah, because, I mean, yeah, we don't need to tune in. It's going to be political gobbledygook.
Yeah, I'm thinking probably.
I'm so burnt out on politics already, and we're just now entering the 2020 cycle. Ugh.
Yeah. So, interesting stuff. Ugh. Definitely not easier than the last round of payments. This is absolutely 100% harder than last year's payments.
Yes, and it seems as though they brought this on themselves by announcing it so quickly. They could have said,
yeah,
we will be looking at a second round of MFP payments. Details will be announced in June.
Well, and that's part of it, too, is folks are upset because it's like, I mean, I think Senator Grassley was even like, this is stupid. This was a stupid move. You should have waited until after planting decisions were made. But then on the other hand, it's like you're kind of just guessing. I mean, whatever you plant is what you plant. So, I don't know. You don't know what the payment rate is. And it's like, so
right.
What should I plant?
And it shouldn't matter because it's going to be determined, as long as you get some acres in the ground, it sounds like, and don't take PP, you're going to get covered for those acres based on the basket of commodities that they're comparing county to county.
It's a mess. Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I want to still talk politics because we friggin' have to, but this is good news. This is good news. The U.S. House and Senate negotiators have reached a deal on a compromise bill. They're going to pass a $19.1 billion disaster aid bill. This will include money for Puerto Rico.
Yep.
It will include money for flood damages. The only thing it does not include is any sort of mitigation payments for the, quote, migrant surge at the
humanitarian
southern
needs.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. But it sounds as though this is going to have bipartisan support, and Republican Senator Richard Shelby said there could be a Senate vote on the legislation as early as today. And in the Senate, Chuck Schumer confirmed that Democrats have backed the legislation, and they were the holdup earlier. So this one sounds like it's going to be successful. The House has already passed. And
I don't think the House has passed it yet.
They haven't passed this one, but they passed their earlier form of disaster aid.
So what I read on that today was the House has already left for recess, so it doesn't sound like this is going to be finished by Memorial Day weekend like everybody was promising. And it does sound like President Trump has written off or okayed the deal, so it sounds like once it's passed in Congress, the president should sign off on it as well.
All right. All right. Well, there we go. We got some positive news coming out of D.C. there if you are one of those folks affected by the flooding earlier this spring.
Yes. It sounds like finally we've got some positive news.
All right. What other news do you have for us, Delaney?
Well, we continue to watch the African swine fever story, and we know that U.S. and Canada have been working diligently to come up with a plan, and it has been announced in a joint statement that U.S. and Canada have agreed to swine fever zones, essentially, so that if African swine fever does break out in the U.S. or Canada, swine and pork trade will continue between those two countries. So essentially what they're doing is putting together zones or zone mapping the U.S. and Canada. So then once or if a disease outbreak occurs in part of those zones, they will quarantine that area and follow the affected or follow the World Organization for Animal Health as far as guidelines for that, but essentially quarantine those zones, but still allow at least the pork to be transferred and traded between the two countries.
From the other zones, the non-quarantine zones.
Yep, exactly.
All right. All right, well, good. That's good news. It's good to have a disaster plan in place, absolutely, because, odds are good. It's going to wind up here eventually.
Yes, it sounds like that will likely be the case.
Well, I've got some other news. What is also likely going to be the case, we have talked about this a lot. Of course, I am a free trader. I am opposed to tariffs. And we got an update here from the New York Federal Reserve. They have done an economic study, and they have found just the newest round of tariffs. So this is the 15% bump on the $200 billion of Chinese imports is going to cost the typical American household $831 a year. And remember, folks, this is $831 in extra taxation you are paying for choosing to buy goods at whatever store you buy goods at. So basically, every American just faced a $1,000 a year tax hike thanks to just this 15% bump in tariffs. If we do put 10 or 25% tariffs on the remaining $300+ billion worth of Chinese imports, we're going to probably more than double that figure. Now we're looking at about a $2,000 additional tax bill for American citizens.
It's interesting you say that because I've been talking to some folks and had some folks reach out. I don't remember where they quoted this from, but they said Purdue made a statement saying that the Chinese are paying for this tariff, for these tariffs, not U.S. consumers, but this goes against that statement, would it not?
Secretary Purdue, I was on the call when Secretary Purdue said that. There was a reporter from ABC who asked and they had who said, isn't it true that American consumers are paying and not the Chinese? And I think Secretary Purdue misunderstood the question.
Oh.
He said that this money isn't coming directly from the tariffs. It's coming instead from the CCC, the Commodity Credit Corporation. But President Trump views it as one big pot. Tariff money is instead going to the Treasury. But yes, tariffs that are in theory funding this MFP program are all additional taxes paid by U.S. citizens and businesses on goods they bring in from China.
Yeah. So maybe he just misunderstood the question, I guess.
I think he did because somebody had asked earlier about what's the mechanism for bringing tariff money over to USDA to fund this program. And he said, well, statutorily, we can't do that. So we're using CCC funds, but the Treasury is getting matched by these tariff increases. So that was, I think, where he thought the question was going. But I do believe he misspoke. I do hope he clarifies that this is not Chinese money paying farmers. This is American money going to pay farmers, American money paid by our fellow citizens in extra taxation. Now that's what's giving us this rebate on the farm side.
So the $831 figure that you mentioned, that is because of this new assistance package?
No, that is because of the tariffs.
Okay.
So that's the additional tariff cost we're all, the average American family, is going to pay.
Because of the latest round of tariffs.
Yes, exactly.
But then they haven't done anything yet that says you also add taxation because of this new assistance package. Am I understanding all that correctly?
Nope. So this this additional taxation, this $831, is extra taxes that every American is paying because our country has put tariffs on imports, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Secretary Perdue is using about 15% of that new tax money to fund this MFP.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So does that clear it up?
Yeah, my brain is really hurting today. I tell you what, this is the most thinking I've done in some time.
And it's such a convoluted topic, and it's such a convoluted way that tariffs are explained, because we put tariffs on Chinese goods. So it sounds like, well, the Chinese are paying it.
Yeah.
No. We're paying it when we bring it into the country. It's an import tax paid by the importer and then typically passed on to consumers.
Okay. I think I follow all that now.
Okay. All right. Okay. And folks, you know, feel free to tweet at us. If this is a net gain to the country, if you think $831 is a fair price to pay to encourage more folks to buy American, let us know. Find us. Tweet at us. Ag News Daily on Facebook and on Twitter. What are your thoughts? You know, I'm pretty well opposed to this thing, but I'm absolutely willing to listen to other people's opinions. Maybe I'm looking at it wrong. So by all means, jump on there and share with us. We'd love to hear it.
Yes, absolutely agreed on that one. The only other piece of news I really had for today, Mike, was related to the USMCA agreement. It felt like maybe we had some positive sentiment earlier this week. It sounded like, okay, we're going to get it passed.
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, after a hearing on Wednesday, it sounds like House Democrats may insist on yet another change or changes to the USMCA trade pact. And I don't know why, but that's what we've heard coming out of D.C. as of today. So it sounds like such changes would ensure that Mexico follows through with implementing promised changes in labor standards. That's really, I guess, what they want to ensure. But
yes.
It sounds like now maybe we're not so close as we thought before.
Well, and, you know, I think we're just getting started ramping up the fight to USMCA. We'll probably see Chrystia Freeland, Canada's foreign minister, make some overtures to American Democrats here in the coming weeks. I think you're right. It's going to be a slog to get this through the Canadian Parliament, the Mexican Congress, and the U.S. Congress to actually get it signed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at least we're talking about it. At least it's moving in the right direction.
Yes. And, okay, wait. I got one other breaking update here that just got sent to me. It sounds like Senate leaders have released a final text version of the disaster aid package that could clear the House or clear the Senate today and would clear the House by what they're assuming to be a unanimous consent.
Oh, wow.
But the House is already at recess.
Gosh, we haven't had any bill with unanimous consent in some time.
It'll have to be after the Memorial Day recess. So 10 days away, I think, is when they come back.
Yeah, we're making progress.
We're making progress.
Folks, as we dig into that text, we will we'll give you an update on exactly what to expect from this disaster aid bill, probably on tomorrow's episode, I would think, Delaney.
I think that sounds right, Mike.
Well, speaking of disasters, we've got a red on the green screen today. What do you think? Should we take a look at the markets?
Well, let's do it.
All right, folks, and our markets are brought to us by our friends at the Zahner Group. Remember, you can get in touch with them anytime. Help manage your marketing risk by giving them a shout, 312-277-0050, or visit them on the web at Zahner, Zahner.com, and tell them you heard it on Ag News Daily. As we look in the corn market, July corn down 4.75 at 389.75. December also down 4.75, closed the day at 408. In the soybean pits, the July was down 7 cents at 821.5. November new crop also down 7, closed at 848.25. And Chicago wheat, weakness today, the July down 2.5 cents, 470.25. September also down 2.5, finished the day at 478.25. Looking over stock side, we did see cattle catch a bid today. June live cattle up 15 cents at 110.80. The August up 20 cents, closed at 108.15. And in feeder cattle, the August contract was up 42.5 cents at 143.02.50. September up 12.5, finished at 144 even. And in the lean hog market front, the weakness, the deferreds have slight strength. The June was down 22.5 cents at 89.42.50, with the July down 10 to close at 90.95. Now, there was a little bit of strength in the dairy market. As we jump over and take a look at free milk, the May contract was up a nickel at 16.38, with the June up 11 cents on the day, finished at 16.45. Well, Delaney, why don't you tell us who are we talking to for our interview today?
I would love to, Mike. We are chatting with the executive producer of the show that maybe you've seen on TV called The American Farm. I believe it's on the History Channel, if I'm not mistaken. So it's Jeff Conroy,
yes,
with Bobcat Studios, discussing the end of this show, which airs tonight. So be sure and catch it.
It does.
But let's hear from Jeff about that show. We're talking about maybe another media outlet that's presenting the life of agriculture mainstream more so this time. We're talking to Jeff Conroy, CEO of Bobcat Studios, and also the executive producer of a program that maybe you've caught on TV called The American Farm. And Jeff, tell us a little bit about the idea that was put together and how you decided to create this program, a docuseries of sorts called The American Farm.
Well, first off, Delaney, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it, Mike. What's interesting about this is the story of getting this show on the air is also like somewhat of it's a bit of a triumph in terms of getting the opportunity to do it. I mean, my partner Tom Beers is so incredibly passionate about this idea for years. And that we literally, I think it was 7 years that we were out pitching this thing and trying to get, a network to take, to tell this story. You know, we thought, we're like, we even said it in the open, this is the great untold story. And in so many ways, that's true. This is a story that everyone thinks they know what a farm is, what farm life is like. We all have these, many people have these idealistic thoughts or these kind of half ideas, or maybe they come from a family that used to farmism. But when you get down in there and you embed and you live with the people who are working this, on these farms day in and day out, like, it's a whole nother story. And, so the process of getting there was a long one, and it was a lot of pitching, a lot of casting, a lot of saying, like, look, this is a really great story to be told.
A great story, and part of the fascinating thing with The American Farm is you didn't just follow one family. You're not taking a single snapshot look at one aspect of American agriculture. You've dug into five different farms and year with them. Talk a little bit about how you ended up finding these families. What about their stories were compelling to you, and why did you want to bring them onto television?
Sure. Yeah. So we did look. We literally, had a map, and we looked at, across the country. Wanted to try to give a wide look, and different farms and different crops and different parts of the country. We wanted to give the best sampling, a sense of us. And then we also wanted to choose farms that were obviously first great characters, people we wanted to spend time with, we wanted to hear their story, but then also like farms at kind of critical moments, right? You want to have a character group that, they're at a pivotal point that is a transition. So, we had generational changes. We had like the Robertson's farm in New Hampshire. Their youngest son was graduating college and coming back. And now with two other boys, that's four families that have to be supported, right? So now that doesn't work for for, you know, their small dairy operation, so they needed to expand. So that was one of the reasons they were very interesting. On the Sunderland farm in Utah, you know, you have the daughter, you know, one of the daughters of a farmer, main farmer there is you know, loves farming. She wants to do it with her husband. So now you have, how do they accommodate for the next generation and kind of pass on that? You have, I mean, actually a lot of it is generational. You know, the Boyd farm in Virginia, you know, he's looking to get his son involved, a son who didn't really grow up with him in a traditional sense. You know, the parents were divorced, and so his son was more of a suburban kid, you know, and so here he is, like, trying to get a 30-year-old man to transition to farming or to become a farmer. It's interesting. And then on the Myers in Alaska, you know, they were really trying to prove that growing in this harsh environment, essentially in the tundra there, was possible, and then trying to expand it. So that's a big thing for them. And then, you know, the Griggs were, you know, in Tennessee. They were, you know, we loved their family dynamic. We loved how you could see the generations play out all the way down to their you know, 9-year-old. And, you know, and they also were, you know, they're also, you know, growing cotton and different crops like that. And of course, they were also needing their, you know, 110-year-old farm that also needed to make some changes in order to survive the economy. So they were also at a pivotal point. So it kind of tried to go broad, try to get a diverse group of characters, and then also catch them at a moment in time.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
That's a very long-winded answer.
No, that's interesting. I mean, I think a lot of folks struggle with the transition period, and it's nice to see it maybe highlighted at more of a national level, because sometimes we feel like in ag we're the flyover states, or maybe mainstream folks don't notice us as much. But Jeff, tell me, how did you explained the kind of the why behind doing it, but how did you get the idea originally? You mentioned before we started recording that you're there in LA. Are you from a farm originally, or how did you come up with this idea?
No. I mean, you know, look, the idea, we, you know, our past shows, especially with my partner Tom Beers, we always gravitate towards the stories of real people, you know, and it's the idea that, you know, there are everyday heroes around us. And that's something that we've always kind of wanted to tell those stories, you know. So, you know, we told the story of fishermen on the Bering Sea with Deadliest Catch. We were able to tell the story of, you know, loggers with axemen and, you know, ice road truckers with ice road trailers. Like telling the stories of people who make our world work, you know. And then always, you know, there's that element of risk and reward that is always attractive in any storytelling for us. So it made sense. So, you know, I keep adding them on. You know, we were with coal miners in West Virginia. We're on the rigs in West Texas. So, you know, it's always interesting to me when you look at our world and, you know, for the most part, everyone, you know, they walk into a grocery store, they get their package thing, they walk out, they scan it, they pay for it. You know, nowadays you might not even have to interact with a human in that process. You go, boop, boop, you know, and you cruise through. I always am drawn to telling stories that change the way we look at our world. So, you know, if you walk into a grocery store now and, you know, you're going to buy that vegetable or buy even, you know, like a tortilla that's got corn and whatever else, I would like the idea of you thinking about how that got there. You know, who did it? You know, who went to the effort of putting that seed in the ground, you know, taking care of it, you know, with their livelihood on the line to make sure it grew into that corn stalk, and then the process of all that. Like, that to me is always very fascinating. And you know, that grew, and a lot of those jobs and a lot of people that do those fall into the category of, you know, high risk, high reward, and dangerous jobs. You know, you search on the internet, you know, simple internet search, and go, what is a, you know, the most dangerous jobs, you know, well, certainly some of the ones I mentioned, and certainly farming is up there. So we're always kind of drawn to that, you know, the people who make our world work, and can we tell those stories and celebrate those stories, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, when I think about some of the other programs you've mentioned, Jeff, the audience gets drawn into the personal drama of the characters. We get sucked into their lives. I'm a huge Deadliest Catch fan. Mm. And, you know, gosh, sure. How many seasons has that been on now?
God, I think it's probably... I'm going to mess it up. I think it's 15 now.
I think it's 12, 15 years. We've been enmeshed in this life. As you look mm-hmm. ahead for the American farm, is that the mm-hmm. same type of model you'd like to go? Do you see yourself going back every year?
I mean, for a couple of years,
really building that relationship?
I would really love to. And I think that, you know, season two and progressive seasons on the show are magical in many ways, because you are able to really get to know your characters at such a higher level, and you're able to tell much more advanced stories. And I think the more advanced those stories, you know, the more they connect with your audience, the more people go, you know, like, you know, you miss things in those early seasons because you don't really know, but as you advance, you understand that character. You know what that character may or may not do to some degree. You kind of get to, you kind of have some kind of spidey sense on how they work, and you can, as a producer or a cameraman, you can anticipate and put yourself in the position so that we can tell a full story, you know. And I love doing shows where we embed, you know, where we are with the people, you know, morning and night, getting up in the morning, and that you can't replicate that. You can't replicate that time with someone. You know, you will capture moments, you will be witness to things that are authentic and real. You might catch it if you're there in and out for a short period of time, but it's hard to replace being embedded in the moment. And I think audiences today are constantly craving authentic, real moments. They don't want to be overly produced to. They don't want to be lied to. They want to feel the real deal, you know. And I think that you know, there's no way to do that but to really embed with you know, your subjects.
Absolutely. And this has been such a cool project. Jeff, before we let you go, you're kicking off the end of this series here. Tell us how folks mm-hmm. can catch that, or if they haven't seen any of the other previous episodes, is there somewhere online they can watch it as well?
Well, I believe they can do it through the History app, but also, you know, you can tune into the History Channel. Here it's 10 p.m. Pacific. I think it might be 9 Central. But it's easy to find on your local listing, and it's on Thursday night tomorrow night. Don't watch tonight. Watch tomorrow. Yeah, Thursday night. And listen, like, obviously I'm crazy biased, but I really think that this finale, this episode 8, is a beautiful show in many ways. I think certainly aesthetically, it's just, you know, I mean, there's what a great palette of a farm to work with. But we really see the culmination of, you know, a year of hard work. And it comes down to this. And, you know, I mean, a lot of us, it's hard to imagine that our entire, you know, fortune, you know, plus or minus for the year, comes down to a very tiny period of time. And that's why, you know, like, I wish every episode was an episode 8, because you get so much that's happening here, and it really comes down to where everybody is. And I think that this episode, to me, was very emotional, and I felt like there's some just, you know, some great triumphs of the spirit. And if you love these characters, I feel like it's, you know, it's a great experience.
Fantastic. Folks, be sure to check it out, the History Channel, Thursday, May 23rd at 10 p.m. Jeff, thank you so much for your work on this program, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you for asking. I could talk all day. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, be sure to tune in tonight at, I think you said 9 Central Time to watch the conclusion of the American farming thing. You know, I'm kind of sad they didn't talk to any Midwestern farmers. Utah, Virginia, Tennessee, New Hampshire. I feel like if you're tuning in next year, let us know. I know a bunch of characters out here in farm country that could really spice up the program.
Yeah, I was surprised they didn't really include any what I would consider, I guess, Midwest traditional farmers, corn and soybeans, et cetera.
Yeah, commodity crop producers on the Corn Belt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but maybe next year.
Right. Well, folks. Exactly. Maybe, I mean, this is one of those things that, Deadliest Catch always had a couple new people coming in. But anyway, listeners, tune in tonight. Let us know your thoughts on that program. Tweet at us. Find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Ag News Daily, as I've mentioned. Or just head to our website. Go to agnewsdaily.com and let us know your thoughts. There's a comment button or, you can submit a comment right there on the new site at the Global Ag Network. Check out all the other podcasts that are there and share it. Share this and get on iTunes and like it. Or star it, or whatever it is people do on iTunes. We need your help.
Yeah.
You do what?
We do. Subscribe. Hit subscribe.
All right. Well, with that, folks, I don't know. Delaney, should we let them go?
Let's let them go.